Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. Delighted to welcome back to the show my buddy, USA soccer superfan, football superfan. He's the former host of Good Luck America on Snapchat. He just announced on Monday that he's joining Puck full-time as chief national correspondent. He's also been the host of the Powers That Be podcast. It's Peter Hamby. What's up, bro?
Hey, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm on the mend. So I've got my Gator Light here, rapid rehydration, and we're doing pretty good. Better than yesterday's podcast. We're going to really nerd out, as is our want, on campaign politics.
Sure are.
We had a lot of results last night that are interesting. The takes are flying. But before we get to kind of going around the map, I just want to pick out a couple of things from the Maggie Haberman, Jonathan Swan book. I think we'll probably go deeper on this next week, but some of the excerpts are leaking out there. I guess we should start with the J.D. Marco stuff.
Yeah.
They had this anecdote in the book about how Trump has redecorated the office, famously to put a lot of gold flourishes in there. Many listeners are unhappy with my take about how I think the more is more affect is a little bit better than what Biden had in the Oval Office. People don't like it. It's my least popular take, but I'm standing by it. Anyway,
wait, I haven't heard this take from you. Sorry. Yeah. You think that you should do sort of maximalist decorations in the Oval Office?
I like the maximalist decorations. When you see the images of Biden, when you see the side-by-side, Biden's pallid skin with like the gray, off-white walls. It's just not good. I feel like as millennials, one of our big misses is everybody, we tried to minimize everything was being streamlined. You know, everybody's houses were more clean, a lot more whites and off-whites. You know, it's like the Cracker Barrel redesign. I hated the Cracker Barrel redesign.
It's like that coffee shop we went to in SLO those years ago where there's like, and by the way, I'm guilty. You can see behind me having like hanging ivy, but you know, the beige countertops and the sort of the sign where you put in the little letters to order the flat white or whatever. And they're playing like a low Tame Impala beats behind you. Biden definitely wasn't doing that. But I do think though, the colors kind of work actually, maybe even the lighting. Things do feel a little brighter in there when you see the camera pool.
They feel brighter. So anyway, I mean, I wouldn't do like everything like Home Depot gold, but I just think as a general matter, a little more maximalism is good. Anyway, Trump was asked about whether he's worried that his successor will undo all that he had done design-wise. And that probably is a real worry for Trump. And his response was that Cubans love gold, which is a little sly, you know, Trump response. He likes to do this. He likes to play these guys off each other. And, you know, he's got JD, you know, eating shit right now on the Iran deal. I don't really buy it that Marco is passable for the Republican electorate, but I don't know. I'm just curious what you make of all of it.
I talked about this the other day with Julia Yaffe on my podcast. Thanks for the shout out. We're on YouTube now, the powers that be.
Welcome to
if
YouTube.
If you go into polling, and I did this the other day with some of our echelon polling, they basically test every question in their battery among MAGA Republicans and Party First Republicans. Now, you, Tim, and maybe some Bulwark listeners would have once identified as a Party First Republican, like the more, you know, traditional Bush, McCain, Reagan types before Donald Trump came along. It's been a minute.
It's been a minute.
But they're still out there to an extent. And they tested, and I just actually looked in the crosstabs. Those are horse race numbers for Republicans 2028. And Marco loses to Vance among Party First Republicans, but not by that much. And he's been creeping up in polls. I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but say he was losing to JD by like 13 points in that horse race poll. Pretty good place to be. Like I always think heading into presidential primaries, you'd rather run from behind than be the front runner the whole time. But JD is crushing Marco among MAGA Republicans, those Trump First Republicans by like 30 or 40 points. And like, look, that's the party. And
you can't win the primary without those voters.
Exactly. And look, I think JD is definitely out there eating shit in the sense that, you know, no one in the foreign policy blob thinks this memorandum of understanding is anything more than a, you know, junior high school level like document in terms of diplomacy. It's unpopular. The war is unpopular. And, you know, JD is also hawking his book right now, which means he's like has this previously booked media tour. So he's out there. And I think Trump kind of likes the heat shield. Honestly, he likes that JD will go out there and eat shit. And, you know, this also comes up in Maggie and Jonathan's book. But Trump can't really talk anymore. Like he's got like a Mad Libs bucket of like 40 words that he grabs into. And he's like, it could be any question. It could be a question about Ukraine. Yeah. And he'll reach in and be like, auto pen, you know, like whatever,
strong,
whatever it is. Yeah. And, you know, look, I think that if JD is eating shit with the press and the foreign policy establishment, Republicans on Capitol Hill, especially Republican senators, and the median voter out there, independent voter who doesn't like Trump, doesn't like JD Vance, doesn't like the war. But the whole ballgame is really the Republican primary at this point, if they're looking around the bend. And, you know, maybe this is a cynical political perspective to have for JD Vance. But if you're him, you know, I think you'd rather just completely own being a Trump loyal soldier than try to do this dance where you're like half in and half out.
And completely own the America First thing, which is like, I mean, even though it's an embarrassing MOU and that it's total surrender and it's humiliating, it does put him in the position of being like, I wanted us out of this, as opposed to being the one that wanted us in. So I think that helps. Yeah. The only fun wrinkle in it is, who knows what the fuck 82-year-old dementia riddle Trump is going to want to do in 2 years. And we'll talk about his aging next. But so will he try to do something crazy? Obviously, what exactly that will look like, who knows? But assuming he moves on to retired life at Mar-a-Lago or in the ADU bunker underneath the White House, like, he will not do what Bush did. Like, it's not like he's going to go away and paint, right? Like, he is going to like tweet and
bleed. He's going to want to play ball,
yeah. And so could he drag Marco across the line if JD pissed him off? Like, sure.
My reaction to that at first was like, do Cubans like gold? Like, where did that come from? I mean, Cubans like baseball and coffee, and Cubans are very patriotic. The Cuban Americans, at least. I just actually Googled this.
Cigars.
AI is so dumb and wrong sometimes, and they just make things up because they're scraping like a Reddit thread.
Yeah, sure.
But this is Gemini. I asked, do Cubans love gold? Yes, Cubans generally have a strong cultural affinity for gold. In Cuban culture, bold gold jewelry, most notably the iconic interlocking Miami Cuban link chain necklace, is deeply valued as a symbol of success, prosperity, and resilience. So if we see Marco in a Pitbull style Cuban chain.
Like a hefty gold chain.
That's funny. That's funny.
But you mentioned that Trump can't talk anymore. These are just a couple other things from the book. He was also having trouble hearing, asking people to repeat questions they had just asked. Haberman and Swan wrote, they started to have press conferences with world leaders in the Oval Office because the acoustics were better than in the bigger East Room where they had been holding those meetings. I find this hard to believe, but I guess these people would know. The people around Trump say that the thin verbal filter that he had in the past was gone. Stuff that he had used to only say in private, he was now saying publicly. I liked this one. Trump was upset about the coverage of his cankles. We did extensive cankles coverage here on the Bulwark YouTube feed, so I'm happy to hear that bothered him. And he asked the press secretary to address it during a media briefing. Some aides thought that was an odd topic, but it was in keeping with his obsession with his declining appearance. And like, this stuff we see publicly, but I think that like, it's pretty notable over the last year that he's visibly declined. And I think that there was a lot of like frustration during the campaign that it was like, why isn't Trump's age as much of a deal as Biden's? And like, it was a fair, fine point to make as an academic exercise, but like, he just didn't seem like he was declining as much as Biden, just in like the physical characteristics. And that is happening to him now.
There's also the makeup on his hands thing. I think that Maggie and Jonathan reported on. And
the neck now. The neck, the hand bruises have moved to the neck.
And look, if you're in the White House, if you have access to the best physicians in the country, and it's very clear he cares about his appearance given his hair and orangeness, but he has to show his hands on camera in briefings or whatever. And people, you know, eagle-eyed people on Twitter like zoom in on his hands. You'd think they have like better kind of concealer. Like it's like mismatched makeup. And so in other words, instead of getting the press secretary to go out there and like talk about the cankles, which by the way, didn't they say something like, didn't Caroline Leavitt talk about his venous insufficiency at one point from the podium? I believe that's the cause of the swelling.
Yeah.
So clearly like they did. I also thought you were going to bring up, and this wasn't in the book, but Stat News reported this the other day, the fact that this is that was an incredible scoop that I forget which, it was either the government or the pharmaceutical company cleared a single use dosage of retatrutide, which is basically like an uncleared peptide. I'm sure RFK Jr. uses it. It's like a GLP-1, but it also makes you jacked. Like, I live in LA. I know people who do like peptides and like get shredded off of it.
I didn't bring it up because I was deferring to your expertise on this.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, someone who's very clearly shredded. The White House wouldn't address it. So it's like a non-denial. It's not approved for anyone at that age using it. And federal health officials got involved. It was a great scoop. It was just very obviously clear that the White House got this for a 79-year-old man earlier this year in April. He's now 80. And I just wanted your take on this, actually, because he looks kind of the same weight. Like, if he is on a GLP-1,
yeah,
he's certainly like slimmer. Like, remember during the playoffs when the White House was posting like him courtside at a Knicks game from like the 90s? Not that he could name or pick Amari Stoudemire out of a lineup, but they were like talking about how much of a Knicks fan he was. He looked like a chubbo in the 90s. Like, he had like a puffy face and stuff.
Right.
He does look like slimmer than back then.
Yeah.
But even compared to a few months ago, if he is taking a GLP-1, he doesn't look skinnier.
Yeah. No, he looks still hefty to me. Yeah, I think he still would be wearing the man's ear. You know, there was also the other Swan Haberman anecdote was that like his room, I don't like to really think about his bedroom, but like his bedroom in the White House is apparently disgusting. Like, there are like candy wrappers everywhere. And like, he binge gorges at night at the end and like leaves like disgusting food wrappers everywhere and stuff. So
I just like that you came out with binges, which I think would be the proper health term, and just switched it to gorges as an ad lib.
And so like, instead of, you know, and if he was having the rare fat shot, you know, that it's only available, you know, on a compassionate basis.
But he kind of teases other people about the fat shot. Like, the TrumpRx.gov initiative includes like you can buy direct from the pharmaceutical companies a variety of drugs at which he says is a negotiated discount. And he talked about the fat shot a lot when they launched this a few months ago. And he would poke fun at people like donors. He's like, I know a heavy set guy, like a fat guy.
Yeah.
I won't say who he is, but he takes the fat shot. Yeah. Like, he makes fun of other people for taking the fat shot.
Yeah.
But it seems pretty clear he has taken the fat shot.
I think that it's very possible that the president of the United States has taken an experimental fat shot. But I don't know that we fully know for sure. It could be another 79-year-old well-connected fatty. It could be.
But didn't they accelerate?
I don't know. Could be.
Didn't they accelerate during COVID? Like, remember when he got COVID? Yeah. Like, didn't they accelerate?
He did take some experimental COVID medicine.
Experimental drugs, yeah. They have access to it, and I would too. I would too.
All right, you all know that I got bullied into getting a cat last year. Slinky and I have a complicated relationship. But he's growing on me. One thing I think I wasn't fully prepared for is the random trips to the vet, the bills, the pooping everywhere. It's easy to rack up hundreds or maybe even thousands of dollars for all kinds of things. There's all these medications and specialty supplements and stuff. Or you could keep it simple and keep those bills down by just feeding your cat healthy. Smalls Fresh Cat Food is protein-packed recipes with preservative-free, 100% human-grade ingredients you find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. Slinky loves how it tastes. But the thing that makes it so good for him is the protein. Cats use protein as their main energy source. More protein means more fuel and more sustained energy. And he's been pooping in the cat litter box for quite a while now. So stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts for a limited time. Because you're a Bulwark podcast listener, get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/thebulwark. One last time, that's 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/thebulwark. Okay, moving on to the primaries last night in New York. Just a total rout for the DSA challengers in New York. The Mamdani slate won basically everything. They had the ad, you might remember from during the NBA finals, where like they're passing the basketball to each other. It's Brad Lander, it's Daria Lisa, Chevalier, it's Valdez. It's these three DSA challengers to Democratic congressmen. All of them won handily. Well, I guess DAC's race was kind of close. You know, that is causing some consternation among the New York establishment. Tish James was offering this morning how she's a little bit concerned about this. You sent me some good analysis from the Yimby Land account on social media, which I follow religiously as a avowed Yimby. And he kind of, I think, summed up the level of concern about these types of lefty challengers thusly. Mamdani seems like a cool dude who really knows how to vibe with all kinds of folks. The second wave of DSA people don't have the same vibe. They're going to say a bunch of shit that scares the hoes and will end up hurting progressives. This will open up a huge lane for ours in 2028. I'm not sure if it's going to open up a huge lane for ours in 2028, but a lot here. Let's just kind of talk about first about like the winning DSA challengers.
Yeah, look, I think you're absolutely right. It's giving Democrats, mainstream Democrats, a lot of heartburn. Someone texted me last night. The good thing about the Mamdanist purges when they come is that they don't believe in prisons.
There you go.
And look, I mean, I want to get into some details of these races. And, you know, I think it's also fair to look at this as a limited New York / Mamdani phenomenon, because we've talked about this. I mean, Mamdani, despite saying he has his music taste is pretty limited when he came on the Bulwark podcast when he was running for mayor, is a, people throw this word around like generational talent, but he just is. He's got it. If you, like you said the other day, like if he wasn't born in Africa, like we'd be talking about him running for president. And like, this is one thing. It's that
this time 28.
Yeah, exactly. He's magnetic. He's good at social media, all of the sort of like tactical, superficial stuff. Yes. But remember, yeah, he ran as a socialist and a Free Palestine candidate. And that spooked a lot of mainstream Democrats and Jews, of course. And like AIPAC hates him. And, you know, this is the reason Dan Goldman lost in the city. Like the Free Palestine movement has replaced the COVID safety movement, and which replaced the, you know, pro-climate sunrise movement. Like there's a through line of like young people in cities there. But he also is governing as a, like, you know, a pothole guy. He was out there shoveling the snow and bringing the homeless inside.
The gays love wearing the 12,000 holes filled shirt.
Yeah. But, you know, instead of like during his campaign, even he acknowledged he did the defund the police thing and then broke bread with the cops and hasn't talked shit about cops.
Increased police funding.
That's happening again out here in LA with Nithya Raman, who is DSA affiliated, not full DSA, who was a defund person who is now running away from that. And Karen Bass is flogging her with that. But back to New York, you know, he's governing not as a socialist ideologue. And on top of the fact that he's got mega Riz and is young, and his speech about the Knicks before the Knicks victory parade, I was talking to people out here in my friend group who like aren't DSA. These people at least weren't DSA fans or Zoran fans. Like, that's one of the best speeches I've ever seen. Like, he just makes politics relatable and tangible to people in a way that doesn't feel academic. Now, these other candidates who won last night, and there are also a bunch of people that went to the state assembly, these are not as charismatic candidates. And in the case of Chevalier, I think that tweet from Yimby Land is correct, which is that, you know, she, by the way, one reason I'm wearing this jersey, she said she was rooting against the U.S. and the World Cup.
Let me run through her greatest hits. Can we just do that?
Sure.
Because look, just in these other candidates, Valdez like seems like, I mean, she's left, but like kind of a conventional Bernie style lefty.
Yeah, but also like labor left.
Yeah. Lander, we talked about the Goldman deal yesterday. Look, Lander has played this very well. And like one thing that's funny, the one you mentioned that when Zoran came on my pod, the question that like that caused the controversy about asking about like whether, you know, he condemns like globalized the intifada. One of the reasons why I was like, that was a totally fair question and he shouldn't have bungled it, was that they had asked the same question at the debate a week before. And Lander gave this great, like, nuanced answer to it as somebody who's like a Jew and wants Israelis to be safe. And like, he wouldn't say it for that reason, but he's also upset about the way that Israel's acting now. Like, Lander just had like definitely navigated the situation, the kind of changing views on Israel's behavior. And yeah, he would have beaten anybody in a primary. He was an extremely strong candidate. I don't know. Should we call her Daria Lisa Chevalier or DAC? I kind of like DAC as an AOC.
I think DAC is easier to say, sure.
Okay, we're going to call her DAC. I want to read you some of her hits. She attended a pro-Palestinian rally in Times Square on October 8th, 2023. So the day after the October 7th terrorist attack, Brad Lander left the DSA over their promotion of that same rally. She had thousands of posts and reposts expressing support for abolishing police, prisons, and borders, as well as seizing private property. She rejected, you know, how some of the lefties tried to spin that, like, abolish the police was more of just like, it's just kind of more of a saying. It didn't mean like literally defund the police. It was,
yeah,
just
it was
kind
a
of like,
it was a budget procedure.
Kind of more of a, it was like more of a bumper sticker thing. It wasn't a, no, she rejected that and says, no, it means ending policing full stop, period. No more police at all, ever. Clap emoji, clap emoji, clap emoji, clap emoji. So there was her view on that. She was then asked about this in this campaign on this New York editorial board thing that Ben Smith is doing. She was asked four times about what to do about murderers and whether they should go to jail. And she couldn't answer that question. She posted, fuck Kamala Harris. She called Joe Biden a rapist. She said that all deportation is wrong. And as you mentioned, she said she was rooting for Senegal in the World Cup. I Googled this morning. She does not appear to be Senegalese, so I don't know why. She has some Dominican and Venezuelan origin, maybe also some Senegal. I don't know. But she said she was rooting for Senegal in the World Cup. And she also has said that when she couldn't find a napkin, she wiped her dirty hands on the American flag. So that's
so you're saying she's a bulwark candidate.
I don't know, man. I mean, I'm open to creative ideas for ways that the Democrats should try to do things differently, but I'm not vibing on that.
She called white women ugly colonizer women.
Also said she was against interracial marriage at one point, I think.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think this is what I'm getting at. And Bernie, to his credit over the years, really has focused on economic populism. Yes, class warfare, sure. You know, taxing the rich, billionaires. He's very uncomfortable with cultural issues. He never, you know, he was more aligned, you know, in the early Trump days and pre-Trump days with, you know, labor unions. He still is, sorry. But like back in the 2019 primaries, 2020, when the Democrats were all raising their hand to like decriminalize border crossings, like that's not Bernie. Bernie, like, you know, he's from a rural state. Like he, you know, isn't like a gun anti-gun or crusader or gun safety person. These are cultural issues, just aren't his bag. He cares about economic issues. And that always set him apart from AOC, who did have prison abolition tweets and does, or has at least talked about intersectionality and pronouns in her bio, you know, whatever, however many genders James Tallarico thinks there are. And so that's, I think, what I'm getting at with Mamdani is for all of his, yes, he's when he's asked about Israel, AIPAC, and Palestine, he talks about it with reporters. But front of mind for him, messaging is like constituent services and like affordability and those things that despite his DSA branding and history, he's governing as just a mayor. And like Chevalier, you know, she's going to get to Congress and it's, by the way, Valdez is also like, don't send any money to Israel, not even Iron Dome. Okay. But again, I think she's more rigorously on message.
I mean, that's going to be the majority position on the Democratic caucus.
Yes. But, you know, I can see Chevalier getting to Congress and being like a louder, more lightning rod version of, you know, Rashida Tlaib. Like she seems like she's a poster. She can't help herself. She is one of these like extremely online, you know, millennial Gen Z cuspers who has made social justice their entire personality. And a lot of savvier politicians, I think, and who's to say if she's savvy or not, because she won, but she's going to go to Washington after having won a D+30 district. And, you know, a lot of New Yorkers are like this, whether they're in politics or not, they think New York's the center of the universe and that she has a mandate to, you know, talk about Palestine and Israel. And it's going to be a thorn in the side of Democratic leadership, I'm certain.
She beat the chair of the Hispanic caucus, so we got to at least recognize that. And he ran a horrific campaign.
Yeah. The New York Times did break out which precincts these candidates won in and lost in. And the DSA phenomenon, while they did make inroads last night with Black and Hispanics, it continues to be a white affluent phenomenon. One Democrat, like close to Jeffries, told me yesterday that the district that Claire Valdez won in, which is a New York 7, called it the most gentrified district in the country. Like this is the MJ Lenderman, like Bushwick voter, right? Like the white, like Columbia protester, like Chevalier.
Just on the front, there's this great video that I said of the her event where it's like they're all shouting, "You're next." They're all shouting, "You're next, you're next," at Hakeem Jeffries, which shows you that this is going to be a thorn in the side of the establishment. And at some levels, Hakeem Jeffries can probably use some challenging. But yeah, no, it's all dirtbag white people who like are just like your classic stereotype Brooklyn look, you know, kind of shouting at Hakeem Jeffries at this event. So
yeah. And I think looking at the broader picture from last night, while New York thinks the center of the universe, Mamdani himself has political capital and spent it to get his people elected. Now, again, outside of New York, the DSA success story is not the same. It's just not.
Let's just pause at that for a second because we're going to go around. Sure. I just have a couple more New York things I just want to hit on. Some of this make your point. So you have Richie Torres, who has been kind of the most pro-Israel Democrat, really, even more so than Dan Goldman, interestingly. He won last night. He didn't have a strong DSA challenger. He did have a challenger kind of pretended to be DSA, kind of. But he's in a more working-class district. He's not in the Bronx. It's not as many, you know, college-educated
renters.
White
not as many white renters. Yeah,
so that's notable. Yes. In New York 12, which is the district that George Conway ran in, RIP, George Conway. I always just thought there would be better districts for him than that, but nothing but love for George. Michael Asher wins that candidate, who's the establishment candidate, replacing Jerry Nadler. Jerry Nadler endorsed
Bloomberg
him.
Spent like a bunch of millions on him, yeah.
He wins that in New York 12. And then AOC, interestingly, has no tweets at the time we're recording this about any of these candidates. I don't know exactly what the plan is for AOC, but she's been very savvy, I think, lately on picking fights, picking battles, or maybe it turns out to be not savvy. I don't know. Who knows? But she has definitely not gone all in with this like kind of DSA crowd to the same degree that you might have thought she would.
Yeah, she's been over the years. Like, again, she had the prison abolition tweets and the intersectionality tweets, the lefty cultural stuff, you know, transgender surgeries for prisoners. She has moved away from that. This is her backyard. She is supposedly deeply involved, and I think she is deeply involved. She was at the Knicks parade. She was with Mamdani, but she, like, whether she wants to run statewide. And by the way, we're talking about the socialists. Kathy Hochul, like, has run a great campaign and quashed a potential challenger from the left who dropped out of the race many months ago, or whether AOC wants to run for president. I think she understands that the, you know, Chevalier wipe your ass with the American flag thing, that's not going to play in Pennsylvania or North Carolina. She is still unpopular with the median voter, like AOC. Like, Democrats and the press are obsessed with AOC. She has work to do with independent voters if she wants to have a larger national profile. But also look at Bernie Sanders. He endorsed Claire Valdez, he endorsed Brad Lander. He did not endorse Chevalier, while Mamdani did.
Neither did Roe, I noticed. Roe, who's been endorsing a lot of those candidates, also didn't endorse.
Exactly. And maybe that's because, like, he personally or his team did a vet, and they're like, she doesn't seem like she's going to keep her eye on the ball, which is, you know, we got to focus on the billionaire class. She's going to be a distraction. And even last night, Bernie, he congratulated, after they won, Valdez and Brad Lander. He did not congratulate Chevalier. And so I think if you are interested in building political power as a leftist in this country, you have to focus on affordability, access to housing and healthcare, and try to mitigate as much as possible the social issues that are going to drag you down. I was talking to someone at the NRCC, the National Republican Campaign Committee, last night, who was just like, oh my gosh, when they call this race, I'm about to go scorched earth. Like, remember in 2018 or 2020 and all the House ads, they would shove Pelosi's face in the ads, the Republicans, and then AOC.
Well, and Ilhan Omar's face would be in there.
Chevalier is going to be that person now for Republican ad makers. And who knows if that matters or not in like, you know, frontline districts in Nebraska. But Republicans will certainly try to make this person the face of an America-hating socialist, abolish prisons, you know, Democratic Party.
The only other thing I'd add to that on AOC is, in addition to kind of like the not engaging in some of the potentially more brand harmful, you know, fights that you're seeing in the activist circles, she is picking other fights. And she's been here in the Deep South rallying against
the data center video she did was really good.
Yeah. So she's been there on the voting rights stuff, on data center stuff, on, you know, her little press conference coming out of the House she's doing during a lot of the shutdown fights. So it's definitely noteworthy that she didn't fully wrap herself in this kind of Mamdani movement. There's some pretty significant GOP fuck-ups. Is this Lovett that I'm stealing this from? There's like always this kind of sense that like Democrats are the responsible party and you expect them to be responsible, and like the Republicans are the children and you don't expect them to. And so like when Democrats do irresponsible things, you really focus on it. So anyway, I do want to bring even-handedness to this because there have been some insanely irresponsible Republican fuck-ups in primaries too. But just really quick before we get to that, around the country last night. So DSA candidates lost in primaries in Maryland and Utah. Wes Moore. And this again speaks to like, having a charismatic endorsee matters. Like a lot of voters just aren't as nerdy as we are. Like aren't in minute 33 of a podcast where they know the details of every candidate. They're like, I like Zohran. He said these are the people he like. I'm going with it. Wes Moore did this in Maryland. He's popular in Maryland. Different type of Democrat, obviously. A lot of the Democrats, the ones he endorsed last night. When in Maryland, one of his endorsees wins over a Pelosi pick in the Maryland 5th District. He won some other local races. Then you got to Utah, Ben McAdams, who's a more moderate candidate. He wins over a buzzy left candidate, Nate Bluen, in the Salt Lake District, that I think the Democrats are going to pick up. Strong Dem, kind of reformist, center-left candidate in South Carolina 1, Charleston. That was that seat that the Democrats did take the last wave year, what that would have been 18, and then Mace takes the seat after that.
Joe Cunningham.
There's been some redistricting since then, so it's not exactly the same seat. But anyway, that's kind of what else was happening around the country outside of New York yesterday. I don't know if you have anything else on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, Wes Moore, you know, I think would bill himself as a results-oriented, pragmatic Democrat. His pick in Maryland's 5th beat back a DSA challenger. By the way, also in New York, I mentioned Hochul, in the 17th district, which is Mike Lawler, Kate Conley won handily. That's like Upper Westchester, Hudson Valley. There was a, you know, Free Palestine justice person in that race who she absolutely curb stomped. You've got Utah. You've got county executive seats in Maryland that DSA people lost in. And this is a larger thing I wanted to talk to you about is the limitations. The question is this a limited phenomenon to New York City, these dense urban strongholds with a lot of affluent college-educated surplus elites, quite frankly, who see politics as a hobby and obviously have issues that they're passionate about. But does it extend beyond New York? Because here in LA, you've got DSA members on the city council who got reelected pretty handily in the primary or will win in November. You've got Nithya Raman, who again is not purebred DSA, but had some DSA support in the past. And you do have in Seattle, you know, a socialist affiliated mayor. We're about to have that in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And so in the blue urban cores, you do see it, but like there's not really like a vibrant DSA in Boston. There's not, certainly not in San Francisco right now. Daniel Lurie has swept most of them to the curb.
Yeah.
And then you go bigger than just the cities where, you know, we have a DSA mayor in Chicago who is a flop, that's for sure. You know, you've got Abdullah Syed in Michigan. If he wins, that would be the first real kind of statewide, I think, DSA success story, DSA affiliated, I think.
Yeah, it depends if you count Plattner, but yeah. Plattner and
Syed. But look at California. Like, California 22 is a great example. So up in the valley, right? This is David Valadeo's district. Randy Villegas is a Bernie endorsed candidate, a young Latino guy who advanced to the general election, beat back, you know, the Jeffries D-Trip person. And, you know, he's running on, yes, he mentions AIPAC sometimes, but that district has more people on Medicaid than any district in the country. Like if he's going door to door and talking about Palestine, you know, he gets waxed, but he's talking about affordability and healthcare. And yes, Bernie endorsed him, but that gets to Bernie's antenna. Like this guy is running on working class, middle class issues. And so I think a real test will be like, that's a frontline battleground district with a Bernie endorsed candidate who is not in a blue urban core. And so California 22 will be like a great test case. And also in California, lots of other socialist wannabes ran and lost all over the state. And yes, it's expensive out here, but so is New York. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the candidate charisma thing can't be undercounted as a big factor in this race. That Mamdani ad you mentioned during the Knicks playoff series was incredible. You had people looking for signal from him. Millions of people in New York, almost everybody tuned into the Knicks playoff games. here's an ad in Zoran Mamdani, who most people like, although less popular than Daniel Lurie, I should say. One of my Lurie friends told me to say that. He's on camera saying, vote for Chevalier, vote for Valdez, vote for Lehner. Okay. Like, that's a validator for me. Good. Like, and like, that's his riz. Like, it's not necessarily, they didn't just win because of DSA or because of Justice Dems or because of, you know, Working Families Party.
I mean, I think we can be honest. I think that the, and I want to get into some counterexamples of this, but I think that the populist left folks are winning the argument on refocusing on billionaires, on economic populism. And on obviously on Israel and
but that's and, not that's the not the populist left though.
Yeah, sure. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I think that like there are a couple different things happening. That's all. It's a big diverse country. Things are happening in different districts. There are a couple different things that are happening all at the same time. And it's like there's like a brand of like social justice left person who, like you said, would have been an Occupy Wall Street person 20 years ago, would have been a climate person 10 years ago, would have been, you know, COVID masking, forever masking 5 years ago. And it's like now this, and that's like an omni-cause kind of left activist person. And like, that is what is being organized in the big cities. And it is a lot of college educated, affluent whites, you know, but they're in coalition, I think, you know, with a lot of minority voters, and they're having success in urban areas, like for sure. DAC is like not going to win a primary anywhere else, right? Like, and that's not like a 2028 path to success, right? Like, there's just there just isn't majority support for that. The question then is more of, okay, like, what is the right path elsewhere? And like, what is the right, you know, what are the things that can be taken from the populist left, or what types of candidates can win? You know, and that's where you look at a Dan Osborne type, you look at maybe El Said, we'll see, Plattner, and different things. Is like, can you run where it is more like a Bernie 16 style thing that focuses on the economic and the foreign policy side and de-emphasizes the cultural stuff? We're about to find out in November, but like, I think that argument is what's winning. They might not be right, but part of the reason I think they're winning the argument is that there's a lot of frustration among Democrats. Like, we tried it the establishment's way. We put up Kamala, Joe Biden, Hillary. Trump won twice. Like, people, like I saw a lot of this conversation on the internet. Like, why weren't people happier with Dan Goldman? And why aren't they happier with Diana DeGette? I'm in Colorado. She's running ads about about impeachment, her work on impeachment. It's like, well, yeah, I'm saying this from Dave Weigel, but it's like, Democratic voters aren't impressed with your work on impeachment because Trump fucking won again. You know, Democratic voters are like, we're looking for something different. Is this thing that is being offered the right thing? I don't know. I wouldn't put my mortgage on it, but I think that it's totally explicable why they're looking for that different thing, given Trump's two-time win.
What I agree with you on is that you can take the economic populism, whatever the argument, like the power utilities are driving up rates for you, or, you know, you can't afford the rent, export those anywhere in the country. I agree with you on that. The social justice cultural stuff, I think, like you said, no one agrees that that can be exported. I think the common takeaway also is the generational aspect, and the fact that I think Democratic leadership in Washington and the older generation just doesn't understand the anger of the base right now. And this happened with Crowley and AOC in 2018, and the issue set was a little different, and it was a different era, and that was the first Trump term. But this just restive Democratic base that says, you guys not only aren't doing enough, but you have failed. And I think this is what we're seeing from this up-and-coming generation who's screaming that these ossified leaders haven't done anything for you. That's valuable, for sure. And I think that is a signal lesson that we've been seeing across primary elections everywhere. Like, that's absolutely the case.
But let's look at some of the Republican fails. We're going to rapid fire through it. Nobody is talking about the Georgia. People are, but
are you saying the media is too focused on New York and doesn't understand red and purple states, or leave their cultural and academic and elite bubbles?
Maybe, Tim? Peter, or maybe these races are just kind of boring and so there's not as much to talk about. But so I will try to make a dramatic statement right now about the races in Georgia and North Carolina that, you know, will hopefully drive attention to races that are boring. I think that the Republicans are going to stop spending money in either Georgia or North Carolina or both by the end of the year. I think that they're going to give up on both of those races in the Senate. Roy Cooper, here are the last five polls in the North Carolina Senate race. Roy Cooper plus 14, plus 11, plus 7, plus 9, plus 8. Like, that feels non-real. Trump won North Carolina. In Georgia, here's the money disparity. Collins, a Republican, has just $1 million on hand as of May 27th. Ossoff has $32 million. He raised 60. But Ossoff is running a perfect race. Collins, the Republican, is, I have to bring this up because of producer Ansley. Remember the Ole Miss kids doing the monkey noises?
Oh, yeah.
The black woman? Mike Collins posted a video of that on Twitter saying, Ole Miss taking care of business. And then the video of the monkey noises. So I don't know how that's going to play in Atlanta, but I think quite poorly. And so, like, the Republicans have somehow managed to, like, take two Southern Senate seats, like, basically off the board by summer. That's pretty good incompetence.
No, absolutely. I mean, Whatley, the Republican nominee in North Carolina, is just a great example of the downsides of this late stage Trumpism, where he just won the primary because he's a Trump functionary and is a lifeless political talent, you know, despite being a former RNC chairman, is also not doing a great job raising money. But the Georgia race also that interests me is the governor's race, because, and this is also kind of a symptom of Trumpism, you have this, I think he's a car dealer, the Rick Jackson guy.
The healthcare executive. Healthcare
executive. Well,
yeah, Trump had endorsed Burt Jones, lieutenant governor, who tried to steal the election in 2020.
That's right. Then you have this rascally outsider spending all of his money, promising outlandish things, and he wins the primary despite Trump endorsing Burt Jones. And I've been saying this recently a lot. If you look at Iowa, look at Ohio, and also Georgia, this is another strength for Georgia. You've got this tandem going on the Democratic ticket, where you've got a very strong, well-funded Senate candidate in John Ossoff, and, you know, Keisha Lance Bottoms, perhaps not as popular, but safe sort of governor choice who will play well in Atlanta and maybe some of the Atlanta suburbs, and, you know, possibly among pockets of rural black folks in that state, balancing each other out. Like, Ossoff will need to get some black voters out, and Lance Bottoms will help him. And I just think that that, compared to the Republican dysfunction, you can just kind of read the writing on the wall in certain races in midterm years. Like, the environment is so bad. There's candidate talent. There's money. Like, fundamentals still count for something. And I'm with you. Like, Georgia, if I'm a national Republican and I'm looking at the map, I'm like, shit, we could put $10 million on air in Georgia this week in October, or we could do that in Ohio, or we could do that in Alaska. Shit, even Texas?
Or we could try to steal Michigan, maybe. Yeah, yeah. Like, if we try to go on offense, take a shot. I think that's probably unlikely, but it feels more likely. The Republican Senate committee is just rake-stepping all over the South, and that's enjoyable. You mentioned, in addition to Trump is losing his touch on the governor's race in Dorsey. As you mentioned, he lost the Georgia governor's race in Dorsey. In Iowa, he endorsed Randy Feenstrom over the Cockering magnate. And then last night, his South Carolina endorsement choice lost.
Got throttled.
That's your neck of the woods.
Absolutely fucking waxed. Can I say that word on the Bulwark? Sorry, listeners.
Yeah, obviously.
This was fascinating and didn't get enough coverage, and also kind of shows how, like, I don't know, Washington reporters kind of miss the forest of the trees sometimes. The South Carolina governor's race, there's a crowded field. The lieutenant governor, Pam Evatt, the lieutenant governor, Henry McMaster, who's one of Trump's earliest endorsers, you know, his team lobbied the Trump political team at the White House for an endorsement, because a Trump endorsement always wins primaries. Trump gave this perfunctory, half-hearted Truth Social endorsement, which he's wont to do in his Kankles era. And, you know, his heart wasn't in it. Like, he didn't go there to barnstorm the state. He's busy. There's a war in Iran. I get it. But Evatt, like, just totally flopped. She won the primary barely, I think, by didn't even hit 30%. I know it was a crowded primary. I can't think of any Republican primary, Tim, in the entire Trump era where one of his endorsed candidates only got 30%. And so I wrote for Puck, like, well, this is bad news. This is a huge flop. People, like, someone from Roll Call was like, Trump's candidates won. Go to the runoff. Alan Wilson, the attorney general, he won by like 30 points all over the state. He won every county. He won Greenville County. And, like, some of that is candidate talent. Like, they didn't scrutinize this person. When you're a lieutenant governor, like, you don't do anything. She's the opposite of Mom Donnie, like, zero riz. And, you know, Trump's gov candidates, like, he's lost three endorsements. Three. And I'm not saying the magic is worn off, because when they put their sweat and money into beating people they don't like in Indiana, in Kentucky with Thomas Massey, the Trump people pull it off. But when they just sort of like fire off this half-hearted endorsement on True Social, like, you know, I think some voters like want a little more than that.
I'm surprised that Nancy Mace's attack on Alan Wilson, that he protected sexual abusers and he dismissed child porn cases. I'm surprised that didn't land. I don't know if that's because South Carolina voters are like pro Epstein now, or because they think that Nancy Mace is crazy.
I mean, having lived in Columbia, like there's just a lot of personal rivalries there for things that we can't even think about. Like Nancy Mace and Alan Wilson and Tim Scott, you know, they were in the state house back in the day. Like there's probably some, they probably like are miffed at each other that someone didn't like buy him a drink in Five Points in like 2007. Yeah. And like that manifests itself today.
Somebody slept with somebody else's staffer, not Tim Scott, because we got to respect asexuals. They're part of the, it's Pride Month. They're part of the LGBTQIA plus community, but it's one of the other two might have. Speaking of Pride Month, any additional thoughts on the Iowa vibrating conquering magnate the Republicans have nominated? We spent a lot of time in Iowa.
FirmTech is a sexual health company, Tim.
And I haven't had a chance to get mine charged yet. We appreciated the gift that the FirmTech people sent me, and we'll see. We'll give a review at some point.
Eleanor would like your review on camera, please. Thanks.
I don't know. Doesn't seem like a great nominee. Things still run at a pace for Rob Sand there in the Iowa governor's race. All right. Are we going to get to dessert? Oh, wait. Before dessert, no. I promised you, if we're going to have you back on, you were smeared. Your reputation was smeared on the Bullock podcast.
I was smeared.
Recently. I guess it's not a smear. A smear would be saying something about someone that is untrue. you were attacked.
No, I was
you
smeared.
You were attacked on the Bullock podcast by my Ian John Favreau. In love, it was a loving attack, because, you know, your takes, we're all out here slinging takes all the time. And so we have some misses. We'll get into one of mine. But you were a little bit more bullish on Spencer Pratt than maybe it merited. That's
my,
all.
My point
maybe
was
a little more bullish.
Let me revisit. I had not a take.
You didn't have to do this.
A deeply reported article examining whether analysis. Spencer Pratt can win in Los Angeles, both as an influencer candidate and as a, you know, crime and public safety Republican, and expand his appeal beyond just white people in Los Angeles. That was the premise.
Turns out the answer was extremely no. No, not even close.
Which I, by the way, I was one of the few people, journalists, who wrote that he has no appeal with Black and Latino voters, if anyone read below it. Anyway, I felt smeared because you lumped a factual statement, which is that Spencer Pratt went around Los Angeles and he never mentioned Donald Trump and talked about Daniel Lurie as his role model, whether that was phony or not.
Right,
you lumped that in with like a bunch of like right wing Tommy Lahren, Clay Travis takes about how Spencer Pratt was going to save LA. And then you were like, and here's Peter Hamby. And you were both like laughing at your friend. I thought that was silly. And then John,
okay, sorry.
Like, you know, also a bud, but like, I'm sorry, guys. There was one poll showing Nithya Raman making
so
her
this
up.
Is fine.
No
okay,
one
I'm
in
sorry.
Los Angeles politics
you were a little
thought that Nithya Raman was going to make the runoff, except for like a handful of people in Silver Lake. Everyone thought Spencer Pratt was going to make the runoff, but those same people, no one thought he was actually going to win the election. And so I just thought, okay. As two activists,
well, it was a miss. That's
making
all.
Fun of a journalist just writing an article.
It was
I didn't
a miss.
Predict that.
Okay. It was a miss. It was a miss. And because of that, I wanted to give you the opportunity to fire back on any bad takes you think me or John have had. I'm not going to concede that it was not a miss. It was a miss. But Favs and I also miss. And so I just wondered if I'm giving you an open swing.
We'll do Favs than you. So John and his team campaigned very hard for Karen Bass in 2022 on their content activations, called Rick Caruso a bored billionaire who can't do the job of running LA. Again, a lot of people here probably regret that. That was like 2022, just partisanship, like vote for the person with the D next to their name. But I think that action, you know, we have since seen because of Karen Bass that it has its limits. I don't want to like talk shit too much. I don't know who John voted for, but
well, I do think that the Pod Bros, you don't have to talk, I'll talk shit for you. I do think that the Pod Bros maybe I've had a change of tune on Karen Bass.
Of course they have. No, but they want Nithya Raman now. And it's funny, yeah. Put them aside. There are lots of Democrats here who just like will be on Instagram saying Karen Bass is a disaster, that, you know, she has failed the city. The very same people who 4 years earlier were saying that Karen Bass was going to save LA against an anti-abortion mini Trump billionaire named Rick Caruso. It's like, you guys voted for this person, you know, and you're allowed to change your minds, I guess. But it's just like, it looks just kind of silly in hindsight.
And speaking of smears, they were smearing Rick Caruso, who would have been kind of a Daniel Lurie style. This is my main pick with your Spencer Pratt thing, is that Pratt wasn't really that much like Lurie, but Caruso was.
I didn't say
Caruso
he was like Lurie. Style,
or my Caruso. Bad take, which I'll nominate for myself, because I was getting dunked on all over social media this week for this. This is kind of the danger of podding. I had like an argument that I had formulated like years ago that was a nuanced take on what Obama should have done with regards to the Merrick Garland nomination, that I shorthanded in the conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates in a way that made it like actually wrong. I had said to Ta-Nehisi that that Obama should have just jammed through Merrick Garland, which many people rightly were making fun of me for, because they were like, he couldn't do that. There were only 46 Democratic senators. The point that I meant to make that I didn't was that in that moment, like Obama quit campaigning for that SCOTUS seat. And like there were really like, and he had two options.
Yeah, he thought the norms would prevail.
The reality is like he thought, and this started because Coates was bringing up that Obama didn't believe Trump could win. And because he didn't believe Trump could win, it's kind of like they nominated Garland and it's like, whatever, Hillary will clean this up next year. When like really, he should have done one or two things, right? Like this will be less appealing to the Coates crowd, but like go to the Republicans and say, who could I nominate that you would bring up? And like actually work with them on someone, and maybe they never would have done that. I don't know, but you could have put pressure on them, like, or like use Barack Obama's skill set to actually go out and make this a major campaign issue that they're blocking this and that they want to take away your abortion rights and et cetera, et cetera. Hmm. And like they didn't really do either of those things.
It wasn't a campaign issue in 2016.
I feel like it was, but like, did he really campaign to get Merrick Garland through? I mean, like, really, like, to the degree that the Republicans campaign for Supreme Court justices, like, was there anything comparative?
I went to good old Wikipedia and tried to remember the 114th Congress, and there were 44 Dems, two independents, 46 Democrats. So if he swapped out Garland, like which of these Republicans would have, you know, disobeyed Mitch McConnell and voted for the replacement? Like Kelly Ayotte? Like Daines? Like Murkowski?
Murkowski.
I don't know. Who would have flipped? Maybe, I guess, but I don't know. People were pretty beholden to Mitch McConnell at that point.
It's a fair point.
I mean, you are clearly wrong.
I was clearly wrong. It's a fair point. I was clearly wrong. I remember at the time feeling like it was a lame duck effort, that there's a little bit of senioritis. And it was like, we're going to put Garland up. And I think Coates's argument, which is maybe a better one, is like, if you're not going to be able to get it through, don't put up mealy mouthed Merrick Garland, like put out somebody that people will be very excited about and make it a campaign issue, you know, so people realize. I will tell you, in 2016, let me just put it this way. I was totally wrong, but I do think this is an important learning. It's like, yeah. I remember in 2016 speaking, because this was really more my world, to many anti-Trump Republican types, college-educated Republican types. One of our mutual friends' grandmothers, somebody that I would mention on this. And she says to me, you know, I don't like him, but I got to vote for him over the courts. You know, we have to vote for him over the Supreme Court because there's going to be an appointment up. And I just don't think that same thing was happening going the other way. Like, I don't think that there was a big effort to be like, you have to vote for Hillary because they're going to take away your abortion rights.
This has been a minor preoccupation of mine for a long time, actually, because for whatever reason, covering Republican politics for so long and, you know, that's how I know you from the pre-Trump era. Like I've just read a lot about the evangelical movement and, you know, their alliance with Republican politics and the Christian Coalition and Jerry Falwell and all of that. The Republican Coalition and the white evangelical vote have long made appointing justices to the court, like, you know, stop Roe, going back to the 70s, like their thing. And you see people on Twitter on the left over the years being like, we've got to vote for Democrats because of the Supreme Court. It just It's never inspired a similar passion with the Democratic base at all. Like, so if Ta-Nehisi is saying, and I listened to that pod and it was really good, you know, they should have put up Ketanji Brown Jackson and that would have inspired people to go out and vote. Like, no, not really. I don't think so. I think
maybe not.
The Democrats are just generally concerned with an issue set. And by the way, they should be concerned, the RBG
and
thing.
Now I think that's changing. I think it's flipped now.
Maybe. But I do think it's always been more judges has always been a thing you would hear in Republican primaries for House and Senate in like Ohio or Texas on the Republican side. And just it's judges is something that didn't really come up outside of like nerdy or like Harvard Law grad Democrats running for office.
A couple. We all have bad takes. That one was mine. I have two desserts. It's a multi-course dessert. We're way over time, so we'll do them quickly. First one, I just wanted to give everybody an update on Brian Noem and Bimbo Vacation. There's some sad news on this front. According to a podcast that Brian's Dominatrix was on recently, on May 17th, 1 month after news broke that Brian was messaging with the Dominatrix, he sent her a text. The text said, "I've been a really bad boy." She responded, "Oh, I know. I know you've been a bad boy." And then after that, she felt bad and ultimately told him that she needed to distance herself and ghost him, that this relationship couldn't move on. So that's just a pretty sad development on the Brian Noem bimbofication news.
Yes, Pride Month, Tim, and you're more fluent in queer communities than I am. Where would, if Brian wants to go full bimbro, where should he move to? The West Village?
I don't know. You know, an early community in trans culture was in Colorado, actually. It's in Trinidad, south of Pueblo. Huh. So maybe he could start a new community there, kind of a bimbro community in Trinidad, because it would kind of speak to their historical significance. And that's the first thing that comes to mind. Fort Lauderdale would be a second choice.
Florida, yeah.
Yeah, Fort Lauderdale, maybe. My last thing is a surprise I have for you. Today is the 17-year anniversary of what? We'll go to the audio tape.
I had a conversation with Gina Smith this morning when I arrived in Atlanta. And I told her about my love of the Appalachian Trail. I used to organize hiking trips. Actually, when I was in high school, I would get a soccer coach or a football coach to act as chaperone, and then I'd get folks to pay me $60 each or whatever it was to take the trip, and then off we'd go and have these great adventures on the Appalachian Trail.
7 minutes later.
And so the bottom line is this. I've been unfaithful to my wife.
Been unfaithful to my wife.
I developed a relationship with a, which started as long a dear, dear friend from Argentina. It began very innocently, as I suspect many of these things do. Just a casual email back and forth in advice on one's life there and advice here. But here, recently, over this last year, it developed into something much more than that.
I was in the room.
You were there.
I was there. So I got a little teary-eyed like Mark Sanford watching that, because that was like, that was my first big break. I broke the news that Sanford's car was parked at the airport and not like somewhere else on the Appalachian Trail, which set off more alarm bells. I was standing right next to Mark to stage left. It was just like I was down there for CNN. It was the biggest story in the entire world. Japanese television came into Columbia, South Carolina, German TV, like different era. All the networks were trying to book Jenny Sanford and Mark Sanford. And by the way, those emails that Mark mentioned, you know how the affair got discovered? Do you remember this?
I don't know.
So he was writing emails to Maria Balenciapour, who's not with anymore. He would, Mark, an oddball, would print them off and keep them in a file folder. And Jenny just found the emails printed off in a file folder. Not good digital hygiene there if you're trying to have an affair. But wow, man, it was a hot summer down there. One other note, I was working for CNN and breaking all kinds of news. They were going to impeach Mark Sanford. The Republicans were doing this and that. Here's a story about the affair and Maria and the cops and whatever. All this fun little tribal politics stuff in South Carolina. And then my boss calls me. I'm in the Hilton in Columbia. You and me love the Hilton. We've stayed there many times. Hey, Peter, what are you doing? I'm like, I got the scoop. The House is putting together articles of impeachment against Mark Sanford. And he's like, okay, cool. You should stop. And I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, Michael Jackson just died. you can come home now. and it was like, obviously the biggest story in the world was suddenly Michael Jackson, and CNN was covering that. And I was having, as a young reporter, like the time of my life in Columbia, like hitting, going to Five Points every night, like I just mentioned. And then I had to go back to reality in DC. So Matt, thank you for playing that. Thank you for playing.
You're welcome. That was today, June 24th, 2009. I was at the Gay Beach House in Rehoboth with all my besties. We had a summer beach house back then, and I made them all take a break from, I don't know, doing Flip Cup and watching Britney Spears music videos or whatever it was that we were doing to watch that. And I just, the whole thing, like my distinct memory is like, when is he going to get to the point? And like, for the purpose of the podcast, we cannot play the full 7 minutes, but it's the longest windup in history. He is such a weird fella, that Mark Sanford. It's a good memory for you.
I forgot that took that long. Yeah. Thanks for playing.
I appreciate you, Peter Hamby. Everybody go check him out on his podcast, which is shorter than mine. If you need a little bit of more of a get right to the point update on what's happening in the day, it's called The Powers That Be. Check him out over at Puck. And Hamby, enjoy the USA World Cup game tomorrow night with our friends. We'll be seeing you soon. All right, man.
All right, buddy. Thank you.
Everybody else will be back here tomorrow for another edition of the show. See you all then. Peace.
What happened to that boy? What happened to that boy? What happened to that boy? He was talking shit. We put a clap into that boy. What happened to that boy? What happened to that boy?
The Board Podcast is brought to you thanks to the work of lead producer Katie Cooper, associate producer Ansley Skipper, and with video editing by Katie Lutz and audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.